I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. After a three-week trial, federal judge Thomas Schroeder will be deciding on changes made to voting in North Carolina. The legislature had eliminated a number of provisions in the law after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the Voting Rights Act in 2013 in the case Shelby v. Holder. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act signed by President Johnson. We'll be talking with the New York Times' Jim Rutenberg about what's happened to those rights in the last half century. But first, this closely watched case in North Carolina. Michael Tomsic is a reporter for WFAE, that's Charlotte, North Carolina's NPR affiliate. He was in the courtroom for this trial and joins us on Radio Times. And Michael Tomsic, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So what were some of the provisions being debated in that courtroom?
The focus is on three big changes, and they were cutting the early voting period here by a week, eliminating same-day registration, where you could show up, register, and vote during early voting all in one day, and no longer counting ballots cast in the wrong precinct. So basically, if you went to the wrong polling place, it used to be that was okay, your vote would still count. They stripped that away as well. This whole sweeping package also included a requirement for photo ID, but that originally was going to be part of this trial. Lawmakers in North Carolina, just a couple weeks before the trial started, watered that provision down so much that they asked the judge for more time to figure out how it affects their case, and the judge granted them that time. So the ID part will be for another day.
And how long had these provisions been in effect in North Carolina?
The 2014 election was the first one. ID will not kick in until 2016, but we had one election, the midterm election, where these changes were in effect.
And tell us a little bit about this judge, Judge Thomas Schroeder.
He's a federal judge out of the Winston-Salem area, and he was appointed by a Republican president. He also handled the there was a preliminary injunction trial last summer that was about whether to put these things on hold for the 2014 election, and he ruled over that as well. So he has had more than about 2 years, basically, of handling this case, knows the facts inside and out.
And he's the sole judge that's going to make this determination.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a bench trial. I mean, there's almost a guarantee that it will be appealed no matter what he rules. And then the Fourth Circuit and potentially higher up could get involved.
What were the kinds of questions the judge were asking the lawyers?
One of his big questions was about precedent. So there are a lot of states, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Pennsylvania is one of them, that does not offer early voting, does not offer same-day registration, doesn't count out-of-precinct ballots. So one of his questions for the Justice Department and others that are suing North Carolina is, okay, if I say these things are unconstitutional here, what will that mean for all of these other states that currently do not offer these provisions? And the Justice Department's main answer to that is, not that there is a voting rights violation just by the simple fact of not having these things. What they've done is build a case that, by the numbers, there's zero doubt that African Americans came to disproportionately rely on early voting, same-day registration, these provisions, since they were enacted, gradually over the 2000s, and use those things to finally, after lagging far behind white turnout and white registrations for decades, use those things to finally reach parity with white turnout in the 2008 and 2012 elections. So the Justice Department's argument is that it is taking away all of these things in one fell swoop that clearly were relied on to a disproportionate effect by African Americans. That is what we contend is the violation, not simply whether someone offers any early voting.
And what was the argument, or what were the arguments on the other side?
The state's attorneys make a forceful case that that's incorrect. They say that, okay, if, for example, out-of-precinct voting is unconstitutional here, then it's unconstitutional everywhere. This is something that is going to be a requirement. They also have pointed out that one of the main things they've done is try to call some doubt into exactly how important these voting provisions were to the African-American turnout increases. They point out that the Obama campaign was this massive machine that caused African-American turnout rates to surge in many states. So Virginia, right by North Carolina, right. The turnout rate increased substantially there for African-Americans in 2008 and 2012, and Virginia does not offer any of these things. So one of their points was, how much credit should the judge give to these provisions as opposed to other factors.
And how soon after the Supreme Court ruled, this is the Shelby v. Holder case back in 2013, how soon after that did the legislature in North Carolina make some changes or offer some changes to these provisions?
This has been a big part of the trial as to the question of intent. So the North Carolina House, before that Supreme Court decision, passed what was a 14 or so page bill that was just focused on ID, and it was not as strict an ID provision as what eventually was settled on. The Shelby decision comes out, and very shortly after, one of the leaders in the North Carolina Senate says, we can go with the full bill now. Nothing happens for a couple months, but then at the very end of the session, that 14-page bill is now close to a 60-page bill, and it has this wide sweep of changes, and the Senate rams it through very quickly. The House passes it with basically zero debate, or at least basically with zero public defense of it, and then it's signed. So that's a key argument from the intent perspective is, you know, this thing morphed dramatically after that Supreme Court decision.
And is this a partisan issue in North Carolina? Are we talking about a legislature controlled by the Republicans?
Oh, totally. And that's actually been one of the ways the state defends the law. So they point out these procedures, early voting, same-day registration, when Democrats were in control of the legislature, they enacted these things. Republicans swept into control in 2010 of the legislature, and then 2013 they took the governor's mansion here as well. It's the first time that's happened in more than a century that they've had both. And at that point, the state's attorneys argue, well, this is now a new party in power with a new view of election procedures, and there's nothing wrong with that. These are just political changes that they think are correct. And I think really what makes this so tricky is the mix of race and politics, because so these changes disproportionately impact Democrats as well. And it's partly because African-Americans in North Carolina are very, very strong Democratic voters. So I think part of the judge's challenge is going to be figuring out, you know, if you can do partisan changes that may look bad but are technically okay, but you cannot make changes based on race in these along these lines.
Michael, you mentioned the federal judge, Thomas Schroeder. Any sense on how long it might take him to make this decision? It's interesting to be talking about it when the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals made a ruling, a determination on voter ID, saying that it did discriminate, a slightly sidebar issue. But nonetheless, any sense on whether the judge feels some urgency on this issue?
He has said that he wants to have his hope is that he can give them enough time that even with the appeals that by 2016 we have whatever the policies are in place. He did not give a real set estimate, but said it would probably be at least a few weeks and could be longer.
But as you said, and it seems with cases like this, no matter what the decision is, the other side will appeal it.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the preliminary injunction trial, which was just about putting this stuff on hold as the big trial played out, that made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Fourth Circuit, the appeals court, ruled that basically the Justice Department and other plaintiffs were likely to win their argument over the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court, without really explaining its reasoning, basically put that on hold. And basically, all of that is just to say that was just a setup for this now, where we're not ruling on likelihood, we're ruling on whether this thing actually violates the Voting Rights Act.
Is this a big issue in North Carolina? And by that, I mean, I might be big on paper. Is this something that people are talking about?
Definitely. With the opening day of the trial in Winston-Salem, there was a massive march right past the court where the trial was playing out. There were, you know, probably a couple thousand people carrying, you know, a variety of signs. People, the NAACP, which is one of the plaintiffs, the North Carolina NAACP is one of the plaintiffs in this case, and they have taken to calling this case our Selma.
Wow.
So it is the kind of thing where there is very, very a passionate feeling on both sides of this, and the state for its case in court that day said, Selma is a big accusation. The state's attorney said, we all look back on that history with disgust. We're talking about voting changes that put North Carolina in line with the majority of states.
And what about the governor?
He has mostly just defended the ID provision, calling it common sense. Frankly, most of the Republicans have given very little public defense of the other changes. They're happy to defend the ID clause. They think that's popular. It polls well. You have not heard a lot of explanation for why the early voting cuts, the same-day registration, and the out-of-precinct changes were eliminated.
About the voter ID, as you said, people are, in a sense, taking a look at that and perhaps reconfiguring it. What had been voter ID in North Carolina?
There was none. You did not need ID previously to vote here.
Okay. And so part of the, as I was reading through some of the material here, that there had been this notion of something like 7 different types of ID that could have been used when someone went to register or went to vote?
So the changes would be, it would have to be government issued is what they eventually settled on. But then there was the provision that watered that down, which you're referencing, Marty. And it's much, it's just a lot less strict now. I mean, it allows you to essentially give a ballot, and defend who you are and still get a chance to vote if you are not able to get an ID.
And what's, generally speaking, what is voter turnout? I realize it varies if it's a presidential year and if it's an off-year election. Are North Carolinians, you know, passionate voters?
I think compared to the rest of the country, it would stack up relatively well. I mean, midterms turnout, it's somewhat comical. I mean, we had a record-setting turnout in our midterm in 2014, and it was still far less than 50% of the population that actually turned out. For presidential elections in 2008 and 2012, turnout rates were around 70%,
wow.
So quite high for those.
And was that across the state?
Specifically, that was so African-American turnout reached around those levels, and that is mostly looking statewide.
Almost out of time here. There was another provision that I read about called pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. I have to say, we're talking to you from Pennsylvania. I don't think anyone's ever offered that as part of voting rights. Is that an issue in North Carolina?
It is. That's another part that the North Carolina NAACP is challenging. And how it used to work is in high schools, you could pre-register folks who would then be set once they turned 18. This sweeping overhaul even stripped that out. And there have been challenges to that provision as well. Why would you take away this thing that just easily allowed people to be registered to vote once they turned 18?
Well, Michael Tomczyk, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Reporter for WFAE, that's Charlotte, North Carolina's NPR affiliate, talking about a ruling probably in the next couple of months or so having to do with changes to voting in North Carolina. It is the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act today, 50 years ago today, and we have a guest, Jim Rutenberg from the New York Times Magazine, waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. 50 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act to end racial discrimination at the polls. Here's Johnson signing the bill on August 6, 1965.
There were those who said this is an old injustice and there is no need to hurry. But 95 years have passed since the 15th Amendment gave all Negroes the right to vote. And the time for waiting is gone. There were those who said smaller and more gradual measures should be tried. But they had been tried. For years and years, they had been tried and tried and tried, and they had failed and failed and failed. And the time for failure is gone. There were those who said that this is a many-sided and very complex problem. But however viewed, the denial of the right to vote is still a deadly wrong. And the time for injustice has gone.
Our guest, Jim Rutenberg, is chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. His cover story last Sunday is titled A Dream Undone Inside the 50-Year Campaign to Roll Back the Voting Rights Act. And Jim Rutenberg, nice to have you with us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
What are your thoughts as you hear President Johnson 50 years ago today?
I've been watching that speech as well as his congressional introduction of the law a few months earlier a lot in recent weeks. And what a powerful moment. And especially, you know, we just had the movie Selma released, and there was some dispute about that movie's portrayal of Johnson's passion for this issue. And I don't think there's any real mistaking his passion when you listen to those speeches.
Your story begins with a veteran coming back from the Korean War, a man named Henry Fry. He decides to register to vote. This is on his wedding day in North Carolina. As it turns out, this is 1956. What happened to him?
Well, Fry, a brilliant student, a brilliant man, an officer in the military, shows up at his local registration center. Of course, this was back in the days when the husband-to-be doesn't have to be that involved in the planning. So he has some time to kill before the wedding, and he decides, well, you know, I've got to register to vote. Interestingly, this is the Eisenhower election coming up, and Eisenhower, as we may or may not remember, was pushing his own civil rights bill. And when he goes to the registrar starts asking him questions. Put the number with the president in exact order, those sorts of questions. Mr. Fry knew this was nonsense, refused to answer, and the registrar said, well, then you are not getting registered to vote today.
He goes and gets married, tells his wife what happened, and then goes back and does get registered. He ends up having to copy the U.S. Constitution. These were the kind of literacy tests. I mean, there were poll taxes and things like that to make it difficult for African Americans to vote in this country, especially in the South.
Yeah, and, you know, I think to me what I wanted to show in talking to someone like Judge Fry, and Fry becomes the first Chief Justice for the state of North Carolina of color, and he also becomes the first black legislator since Reconstruction, you know, after the Voting Rights Act passes. But I wanted to show that people are still alive who remember what it was like.
Well, and what's fascinating and just sort of amazing and even shocking, as you write, when you look at the difference before and after the Voting Rights Act, when it came for registration for voting for African Americans in Mississippi, in 3 years, it went from 7% to 54%.
Yet this law is considered one of, if not the most effective federal law of the 20th century. And even its critics will say this to this day. It was amazing. Now, one thing it had that was – it had a couple – actually, sorry, there were a couple things that were really extraordinary. But one was that federal registrars went into those states and made sure that these black voters were registered. They weren't going to take any nonsense from the local registrars who, as Johnson put it, found ingenious ways to deny the vote. Because let's not forget that the vote was given to black voters after the Civil War and taken away. So very key and something that people still remember to this day, especially in the South. So that was a key thing. Secondarily, the federal government was given extra oversight over all the voting laws in those states. So the effect was swift and extraordinary and upended American politics forever.
And is that the Section 5 that has been debated about more recently and actually tossed out of the Voting Rights Act?
This is Section 5. And Section 5, from its inception, were really stuck in the craw of what were then the Southern Democrats, what became the Southern Republicans. And to them, it is extraordinary, okay? I don't think anyone quite denies that. The federal government was telling a selection of states, you are especially bad actors. You are going to have – the federal government is going to tell you states – remember, this is – states' rights is a phrase of the time. We're going to tell you states how you're going to conduct your local affairs, and if you get out of line, we are going to block you. Extraordinary. So that helps have a huge effect, but that's from there is where the opposition remains against this law until present time.
And I do want to talk about that. You had mentioned President Johnson going to the U.S. Congress to even before the signing of the Voting Rights Act. I do want to play just a small clip, and this is the president addressing a joint session in Congress. It's March 15th, 1965, urging them to pass the Voting Rights Act. It's a speech called The American Promise. Let's give it a quick listen.
The command of the Constitution is plain. There is no moral issue. It is wrong. Deadly wrong to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country. There is no issue of states' rights or national rights. There is only the struggle for human rights.
And Jim, it's just, first of all, it's just so interesting to hear President Johnson speaking, but also just as a reminder that in many people's lifetime, just within the last 50 years, how different the country was.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I love that speech. We're posting it on our site today as well. I like that. I think that speech is more important than the one on the day he signed. And what's interesting to me that, first of all, yes, the tone. When is the last time you saw a president address a joint session with that much anger? But what a huge issue. You know, citizens being denied the right to vote. It's just gigantic. But to me, what's interesting there, too, is what Johnson also says in that address is we have tried. You know, the first couple of civil rights bills had the voting provisions very much watered down. And I actually spoke with Bill Moyers about this last night, because Bill Moyers, the television journalist, was then an aide to Johnson. And I was asking him about this. He seems very angry. And he said that Johnson was very angry that in the first two big civil rights bills, the Civil Rights Act of 56 and the Civil Rights Act of 64, that he had to give up the voting provisions. The resistance was too strong, and he had to get these bills passed second time as president signing it. Because just to end segregation, but it stuck in his craw. So he says to this joint session, you know, you watered these down. I'm done. This time we are not watering down this voting provision. It's the number one priority as an American citizen.
That's Jim Rutenberg. He's chief political correspondent for the New York Times magazine. Wrote a cover story last Sunday titled A Dream Undone Inside the 50-Year Campaign to Roll Back the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act is 50 years old today, signed by President Johnson on August 6, 1965. To join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How much did the Voting Rights Act, Jim, really change our political system and even change our political parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party?
This, to me, is something I've always known. I've been covering politics for, I don't want to even say it, 20, almost 25 years. And you always knew, one always knows, yes, this, the party's changed during the Civil Rights era, but I hadn't realized the depth of it. And it really, we are still living with the vestiges of it today. Our politics would not look anything like what they look like now if it weren't for the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So what happens is you have these Southern segregationist Democrats, your Strom Thurmonds.
The Dixiecrats, right?
The Dixiecrats. And they are furious, but the country has moved away from them. But what happens is, and this happened after the Civil War as well, that because the Voting Rights Act floods the political system with a new voter, black voters, and the black voters' loyalty is now to, it was to the Republicans after the Civil War, it is now to the Democrats. So you have a flood of new pro-integration, obviously, black voters. So in the primaries in the South, a conservative Democrat, and the Democrats controlled the South. The Republicans were a nothing party. They were like, you know, not even the Green Party. So they're nowhere. So these Southern Democrats cannot win a primary now. There's no way. The black voters have totally liberalized the party in the South. So these guys, all guys, switch to the Republican Party. That fundamentally changes. The Republican Party was a civil rights party. But it sees a way to win the South McGovern tries to really kind of capitalize on this by running a very race-based campaign, because one other thing that they need to do is that your everyday voter, segregationist Democrat, many of them stay in the Democratic Party, unhappily, but they stay out of, you know, inertia, what have you. So to get them, these new former Democrats, now Republicans, needed to play to their racism and play to their segregationist views. So you have, thus, the Southern Strategy. Take it from there, basically the party's flip sides over the decades. And now, now we don't talk about race anymore, and the country's definitely moved on. But that was the genesis of how the parties ended up.
And did African Americans register as Democrats because of President Johnson, because of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act as well?
Very much, very much. Because then also what happens is the Republicans, especially in the South, have made a bargain. They are going to win kind of especially big national elections in the South, but they're basically saying sayonara to the black voters. So it's a combination of those two things. And then you have and then you have policies that spur out of that in terms of, you know, social welfare, what education, what have you. But yes, fundamentally that loyalty, it becomes unshakable.
And I do want to talk a little bit more about this march through history. Let me get the William from media to join our conversation. And William, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I was a civil rights worker in Itabena, Mississippi. The day the Voting Rights Bill of 1965 passed, I remember watching it, the president sign the bill on television in my black landlady's house that night. And that very weekend, federal employees reported to Greenwood, Mississippi, the county seat of Lee Flora County, and began registering voters. And we were ready with them, with 20 to 40 black residents of Itabena who we had gotten. We'd ferried over to Greenwood about 8 miles. That's a memory that I bear with me.
Well, William, that's a really powerful memory, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times just to, you know, paint that picture for us. Jim, anything you want to say?
Well, again, it reminds me of, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, and I wonder what our caller has to say about this, wrote in his decision he strikes Section, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but he guts part of the law, Section 5, by saying history did not end in 1965. However, we have so many people who remember those days, and we have people who remember what it was like personally not to be able to vote. So there's a wariness that I think is quite justified and deserves sensitivity, no matter what one's position is on this issue.
William, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jim, this is such dense and important and complicated history, but let's talk a little bit about some of the voter ID laws that were put into place. Interestingly, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has struck down Texas's voter ID law, saying that it was discriminatory. There was a debate in this state over voter ID. Where did that come from, the idea that there was voter fraud? It turns out not to be true, but that there was systemic and pretty sort of outrageous voter ID, people trying to vote who weren't allowed to, or voting multiple times.
Well, what happens is, my piece, I think this could, other people could peg it to other times. I peg it to, I think most clearly, something called the Motor Voter Act. And this was in the early 90s. Civil rights activists and the Democrats wanted to make it easier for black people and poor people to vote. And everything benefits all Americans in this view, right? But kind of help raise the registration levels and maybe help raise minority turnout was still very much lagging. The Republicans were very much against this. They knew these votes were going to be – the people who registered and Democrats hoped voted were down to the benefit of the Democrats. And there was a lot of resistance and there was an argument. The argument became then this is going to lead to fraud. Bill Clinton wins the presidency, signs it. Registrations bounce for a while, not forever. And you have the kind of birth of this movement, mostly conservative movement, saying – we're going to have all kinds of registration fraud and fake people voting. And it becomes this sort of an idea more than a reality. Now, what is real is election fraud.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And that is different than impersonation, right?
Yeah. It's very hard to steal an election by pretending to have people pretend they're someone else and vote twice. It's much easier to stuff ballot boxes with absentee ballots under false names. So Anyway, what you have is a kind of conflation of those two concepts, the beginning of a movement. I could go on for hours, so to shorten it, Florida, the Florida election becomes a focal point. There are accusations of fraud. There are lots of, especially black voters, disenfranchised. And out of that, we have a new conservative movement of even stronger, we need voter ID to clear up these elections. Because what Florida teaches everyone is the smallest margin can decide a presidency. So it's a new place to fight. And we don't see real modern day voter ID laws until the kind of the middle of the Bush years. That's when they start happening. And then they crescendo post Obama.
And when you talk about Florida, that's Bush v. Gore, the hanging chads, all of that,
yes.
Right?
Yes, forgive me. Yes, it's that recount.
How soon we sometimes forget.
Yeah.
But what then do you make of this Fifth Circuit Court ruling and basically striking down Texas voter ID law?
I think it's pretty important. It won't be the end of that case. North Carolina and Texas, there are cases, as we've discussed in both of those. Those are two cases. But that... For now, that was a very surprising ruling because it showed that a circuit that's known to be somewhat conservative could find that these voter ID laws, they're not all created equally, and they do have some outsized effects for some people. That panel found that law discriminated against blacks and Hispanics.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're getting a little funny sound on your line, so I don't know if we need to check it or not, but let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Jim Rutenberg. He's a chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, joining us by Skype, and we are talking about the Voting Rights Act, celebrating its 50th birthday or anniversary today, August 6th, 1965, signed by President Lyndon Johnson. And our guest wrote the cover story in the magazine last Sunday, titled A Dream Undone, Inside the 50-Year Campaign to Roll Back the Voting Rights Act. We're going to take a very short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about as we talk about voting and the Voting Rights Act. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Jim Rutenberg about the Voting Rights Act 50 years ago today, signed by President Johnson. And folks, we are talking about voting here on Radio Times, on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. And again, open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Jim, it's so interesting to be talking about this historic document and how important it's been for the country. And then you get these depressing sort of analysis or after an election and you find out, you know, 17% of people went to vote. I think in Philadelphia, midterm election or even in the election for the new governor last fall, just a paltry turnout. How do you reconcile that? Why don't we take the right to vote more seriously?
Well, I think we, as we all know, we're living in an interesting political era where, first of all, there's just immense cynicism about government. I mean, we've had a lot, you know, full two presidential terms of mostly gridlock. And it was hard before that, you know, because unless you have a really exciting local state election, it can be very hard to boost turnout. And those states that had very competitive elections where a lot of money was spent on television, you did have some better turnout in 2014. But in races where it was almost a foregone conclusion, forget it.
You had mentioned John Roberts, and he, before he became Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, he was a clerk for William Rehnquist on the Supreme Court. What role does he play as we talk about the Voting Rights Act?
I think he's one of the most important, if not the most important player of our times. And Roberts came out of this, well, first he asked Rehnquist. Rehnquist was very hostile towards the civil rights legislation. And Roberts was there, did a clerkship, absorbed some of that, probably held some of it himself. He gives the sort of anti-voting rights movement and some intellectual ballast. And he's not alone. There was a handful of very important conservative thinkers. And their argument was, yes, this law was fantastic. It worked. Done. It did its job. Now all it will do is serve to be what they would say is an affirmative action program for politics. The argument became, that this now states are being punished for the past unfairly. John Roberts was making these arguments, and we know this from memos he wrote when he was a young aide in the Reagan administration. He thought this in the early 80s, that the work is done and it's time to move on, and all this does is kind of warp the system in a way that's not quote-unquote colorblind. It violates the idea of a colorblind constitution, so it's time to drop some of the Voting Rights Act's provisions.
But what's interesting is you look at the Voting Rights Act through the last 50 years. Ronald Reagan, signed the Voting Rights Act. George W. Bush signed it as well. I mean, Republicans and conservatives have signed on for it. But what changed, I guess, in Shelby v. Holder? And I realize, and that's not, that's not Congress. That's the Supreme Court.
Well, first of all, Reagan, there was a move within the Reagan Justice Department and the Nixon Justice Department to get them not to sign it. But the politics were too strong. And, I don't want to speak out of turn here without looking at the decision in front of me. But, there was a statement during at least some of the arguments that the political class, even Republicans who want to get rid of this, never will because the politics are too hard. The politics are too hard. So Shelby comes along and leaves it to this conservative court, which has a bench full of people hostile to what we're talking about always when we talk about the Voting Rights Act is Section 5, this extra oversight of these mostly southern but not exclusively southern states.
So we go to Shelby v. Holder 2 years ago, 2013. What did the court decide?
So what the court said was now here's where this gets crazy technical, so I'll ask our listeners to bear with me, but there's a section called Section 4 in the law, and that decides what states are going to be covered by Section 5. And what the court said was this Section 4 is based on pre-1965, and it's unfair, and it has to go. Now, that said, and as you mentioned, Congress had just reauthorized Section 4 for another 25 years in 2006. So Congress, going through thousands of documents and data, decided that it was warranted to keep this law going. They strike it. So now the Section 5 oversight is kaplooey. It's meaningless. So basically, it takes out two of the strongest provisions of the act.
I do want to play another clip. This isn't Chief Justice Roberts. This is Justice Antonin Scalia. And again, a little technical, but I think worth hearing what he has to say. And he's explaining the removal of these provisions we've been talking about in the Voting Rights Act. And this is in 2013.
This last enactment, not a single vote in the Senate against it. And the House is pretty much the same. Now, I don't think that's attributable to the fact that it is so much clearer now that we need this. I think it is very likely attributable to a phenomenon that is called perpetuation of racial entitlement. It's been written about whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult to get out of them through the normal political processes.
Jimmy's saying that it sounds like he's saying the Voting Rights Act is a form of racial entitlement.
Yeah, and again, that argument goes back to the early 80s and that kind of Reagan era. But what's interesting to me about Scalia there is he's saying we as a court are overruling the Congress, that he just said it, not a vote against this in the Senate, and maybe a low 30s against it in the House, that we know that the intent wasn't really, what they're basically implicitly saying is that Congress didn't really, they're just doing this out of inertia, political correctness, and we know better. It was kind of an extraordinary moment in American politics.
So where does it stand today? I mean, we began by talking about a case in North Carolina. We've got this ruling on Texas. I mean, it seems that some of these provisions, and certainly the voter ID, also Section 5, that is in flux.
Well, yeah, there are a couple moving parts. So what I was going to say about Texas before my sound muffled was Texas and North Carolina are going to decide how strong what remains of the law is. So Texas is not fully, that's going to keep moving through the courts. We don't know what the courts are going to say. North Carolina is almost a more interesting case because it's got those, more of those nuances about early voting that you were talking about earlier in the show. And the question is, can what remains of the Voting Rights Act block those? So what the state in North Carolina is arguing and its allies is these were voting conveniences and they shouldn't be locked in. Now, under Section 5, they would have been locked in because under Section 5, this is a big boil down, minority voters Their gains were considered very fragile. So anything that dropped their gains, anything they used in disproportionate numbers that had a real effect, you couldn't really take them away easily without a fight from the federal government. So now we'll see if the remaining provisions can kind of hit a similar kind of can effectively work the same way. And that's a really big open question. Then you have a movement on the Hill to restore Section 4, and that has not even really gotten a debate.
But what's so interesting to me about these provisions in North Carolina, much more generous than in Pennsylvania. Now, we were part of the union, so we're not considered a southern state and not covered under the Voting Rights Act. But, you know, when you compare and contrast, it's much harder to vote in Pennsylvania than in North Carolina.
This is true, and this is an argument that the defenders of these laws make. And by the way, again, parts of New York fell under Section 5 in the end because of language.
That's right.
So some northern states fell under this. But, you know, the argument back is that history does matter. And that's the big thing. That's the big argument underlying all of this. How much does the history matter? So you could argue, and what the opponents of these laws argue, is history does matter. And again, these voting rights are very fragile, especially in these southern states that had pure Jim Crow. So why did early voting come? Because it's still very hard for poor people, in part, to get to, and hardworking people with working five jobs to get to the polls on Tuesday. How can we make that easier? That disproportionately it fell upon minorities that, you know, it was harder for them to vote. So let's make it easier, early voting. So these are things that sort of the vestiges of the Jim Crow, what have you, remained, and the idea was let's make it easier to vote in general. It helps everyone, certainly helps these groups that historically in the state of North Carolina were denied the vote. The other side, the most interesting thing to me in that North Carolina trial was when the state gave its opening arguments, it said North Carolina's history is not on trial here. The other side very much disagrees, and that's the crux of all of this.
Well, let me get back to the phones, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking about the Voting Rights Act with our guest Jim Rutenberg. He's chief political correspondent for the New York Times magazine. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Lois from, looks like, Newark, Delaware to join us. And Lois, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like the host or the guest to speak to the suspected Karl Rove idea for Florida Governor Jeb Bush in May 2000 to purge 25,000 supposed felons from the voter rolls, where I believe, I'm not sure, but only 2% were felons. And as a personal example, even my brother, who lives in Florida, got a letter that he had to respond to in order to clear his name to vote in November, that he was not a felon.
Fascinating. Lois, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jim, can you weigh in on that?
Yes. Karl Rove has never been connected to that felon purge. But what that came out of was there was real election fraud in Miami. And it was absentee ballot fraud. So Florida responded by working up a purge list of felons, because what it turned out was that a lot of felons had voted. The people had voted under felons' names in this Miami election. So they worked up a very shoddy list of possible felons. And unfairly, a lot of people were included on that list, disproportionate minorities who were not allowed to vote. The estimates for how many are a little tricky. It ranges from one estimate is 1,100 people were not allowed to vote wrongfully. One estimate goes up to 20,000. That election was decided by 537 votes. So there were other factors. Some felons got to vote because some precincts said, we're not using this list. A lot of people said, why am I on this list? I'm not a felon. So no one has linked that back to Rove. It was a disaster. It resulted in people being blocked from voting, and it was disproportionately affecting minorities.
We have a Facebook comment from Mac. I'll read this. One person, one vote is not the same thing as democracy. We're a constitutional federal republic. Only those people who are qualified to vote, i.e. citizens, have that privilege. Those who fear voter ID prefer to think of the qualification to vote as anybody who can get here, whether legally or criminally, and big money does not prevent citizens from voting. What I see from Mac and his Facebook comment is that it's not that hard to vote in this country.
Right. It's not. But, you know, and this again came up in North Carolina. The judge kept asking, you can vote. I mean, so you can't go early. But again, for some people, everyone does not have an equal chance at voting because of one's economic situation or, you know, other historical socioeconomic factors.
In your big piece for the New York Times Magazine, you do write about the new Black Panther case here in Philadelphia. This goes back a couple of years, but I think it bears just a quick repeat about what happened there and what Holder did or didn't do, and perhaps some of the reaction to that.
I mentioned the new Black Panther Party case because what happened into the after Obama's election was you had a couple of key things that helped feed the idea that we need to tighten our elections and there's rampant fraud. So the new Black Panther Party case, you guys know in Philadelphia,
sure,
probably more than I do, better than I do, that there are two gentlemen, members of that party, who were standing in front of a polling place, one with a billy club, allegedly saying some horrible things. And members in the Bush Justice, lawyers in the Bush Justice Department, who were very much pro-voter ID, very much pro-voter restrictions, wanted to bring a major case against these two guys. And what the Holder administration and his leadership came in and found that some career people thought there wasn't a great case, that voters hadn't been dissuaded from voting, that in a similar case before the Bush Justice Department, when it was white people standing in front of a polling place doing something very similar with Hispanic voters, that there was no case brought. They basically, as Philadelphia knows well, dropped most of the charges. It becomes a giant controversy, and it raises this idea that, A, when you combine it with this scandal involving the Acorn fraud, registration fraud, which we don't know what that meant in terms of actual votes, but Acorn registered a lot of fraudulent registrations, that this was just – the fraud is rampant. It's out of control. Here's that maybe Obama even owes his presidency to fraud. Race is – all throughout this, right? And a poll that I cited in my Republican voters thought, yeah, without fraud, Obama wouldn't be president. Hmm. And that feeds the frenzy into 2010 for more and more of these restrictive laws.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here. So can you anticipate or even imagine a time when this becomes settled and we're not fighting about regulations or lack of regulations and who gets to vote?
I am starting to think the following. I think the politics of this, after the year we've had with Ferguson, the Charleston shooting, the Confederate flag, I think the politics of this become really problematic for Republicans. I also think it presents an opportunity to start making gains with the minority community. So at least maybe some of these laws, if Republicans and their base and even some Democrats think fraud is just too rampant, maybe there'll be a way to do it where both sides can be accommodated and people remember, and the Republicans are kind of sensitive to the horrible history here for minority voting in this country. And maybe there's some kind of coming together. I actually could see it because the Republicans have to build their base. And after the year that the country's had, I just don't know if this is the hill they want to fight on.
Well, Jim Rutenberg, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Chief political correspondent, wrote a piece in the New York Times Magazine, a cover story last Sunday titled A Dream Undone Inside the 50-Year Campaign to Roll Back the Voting Rights Act. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, how to sign up for the newsletter, how to listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.